This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Well, welcome back to Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Yes, the pod. We're here with our great friend, Jonathan Gurko. Had an incredibly powerful in the weeds talking to our neighbors conversation about publicization. But Jonathan, in that intro though, your other claim to fame, AQ, the Association for College and University Educators. I love the introduction, the whole idea, the Association of College and University Educators. You founded this. It's 10 years now, the organization. You're the president. Why? What was your driving force? I mean, there's something in there, obviously, college, university, education. Make it make sense.
Yeah, well, look, success has many mothers and fathers, and I think we're now established enough to call it a success, and I'd be remiss if I didn't give credit to those other co-founders, Jeffrey Leeds, Penny McCormick, Doug Sadenberg, Brad Felix, and many others on our amazing team. It's really a simple insight. As professors, myself included, we're not taught how to teach. Yeah. We are subject matter experts. We produce world-class research in this country, research that powers the most innovative economy in the history of the world, but we're not taught as instructors. And we founded AQ with other leaders in higher ed, Eduardo Padron, the late Molly Broad, and others, because success efforts, the college success agenda to reach 2030 completion goals, was focused nearly entirely outside of class. Think of advising. Peer mentoring, supplemental support, digital nudges, scholarships, spot grants. All of that is about access, support, but it's not where the action is. What it does is what I like to say, it ignores the core. And the core is teaching and learning between professor and student.
Right.
So we said, look, we're not going to reach those national completion goals. We're not going to help institutions deliver on their promise unless we get really serious about quality college teaching and learning. Right. And that's what we do. Now in our 10th year, 42,000 professors nationwide hold an AQ credential that might be a full certification in effective online teaching or effective classroom teaching. It might be a pathway certificate building toward that full certification. But given typical teaching loads, that means 5 million students, college students, are getting a better education from those professors. And we know it because we have published, now pushing 24 rigorous longitudinal studies that show, guess what? A, professors are hungry to become better teachers, to improve their craft. They do improve, and teaching improves, and we see it in higher student grades, completion rates, lower dropout rates, higher retention to graduation. So teaching works, and we got to see it in every college classroom, full stop.
I think when you talk about that too, the kind of the other initiatives, because, you know, college, university education, there is this, it's a campus experience. And the idea that we've said you've put a lot of time into, should we have better advising? Should there be better hubs for the students to get together? Should there be, and the answer is yes, 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 yes. But yeah, wait a minute. They're going to college and university to get an education in some form of credential. And when you talk to students too, they'll say, you know, they're pretty quick to tell you that a lot of their college experiences with teaching and learning are some of the places where they have the most complaints. Because what you point out, Jonathan, too, which is a fact, it's not a critique, it's a fact, which is that professors at colleges and universities aren't taught to teach, aren't taught to think about learners and individual learning styles and individual learning needs and how we can tool assessments in ways that make sense for certain. You know, it's just not part. It's like you said, they're experts. They know, I think, Johnny, you pointed out, you know, they know a lot about certain adhesives and how those adhesives and how much they make things stick together. And nobody knows more about how to make a certain adhesive stick together than Dr. So-and-so. And when you come to their class, they're going to tell you everything they know about adhesives. And guess what? That's part of teaching, but it's not what it means to actually engage in an educational discourse between a faculty member and a student when your goal is learning. Does that make sense? Did I do okay there, Jonathan?
Look, you nailed it on the head. It is, as I like to say, not professors' fault.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it is higher ed's problem to solve. You know, we're no longer in a world where look to your left, look to your right is satisfactory. Mm-hmm. We're no longer in a world where those dropout rates can be horribly inequitable by race and class. Mm-hmm. And it's not just student anecdote. The National Science Foundation has done a lot of research in the STEM areas. And, you know, there's solid evidence to show that the one of the major top reasons why students change majors out of STEM or leave college altogether is because of the quality of instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And what a, I mean, in some ways, what a simple fix.
Right.
Right. Right. This is actually in institutions' control to say, we're going to have world-class instructors and researchers. And there's a 40-year literature that shows what good teaching is. There are programs like AQ that we can bring to campus to certify everybody. And it's in our own self-interest because we're going to see retention and ROI and all those good things.
I wondered, though, and you started getting to it there when you say AQ, but somebody says, okay, great. We want better teaching. We want better learning. We're great. Why would AQ make a difference in that? So I'm a dean at a university and I'm listening to Jonathan and Johnny and Tim and oh my God, wait, there's a committed organization with a 10-year history that wants to create better teaching. What happens when I go to AQ? I mean, what do I learn? What is it that you do? How do I get better, Jonathan?
Well, you answered your own question in a way, right? Rather than reinventing the wheel, there's AQ, which has been at it for 10 years, has proof of student impact. We've built the courses and the training experiences that's ready to go. And that's a lot easier than a DIY. We're going to try to do this ourselves for all of our professors. What does it mean to get AQ certified? Well, it means you're going to take what I think is the highest quality teaching, college teaching methods course you could possibly find in the country. Just like future K-12 teachers have to take their methods courses, what we offer online, modular over 8-week experiences, year-long experience, sometimes asynchronous self-paced experiences. But what we offer is equates to 3 credits of graduate study in college teaching methods. In a learning design that's collaborative, you're going to be there with peers. Certification courses are facilitated, so you're going to get coaching and real-time feedback. And that learning design requires implementation. So you can't just sit, do some chat boards, watch some videos, and call it a day. To get AQ certified, you've got to choose from among recommended evidence-based practices, implement it in your teaching, reflect in writing on that experience to keep scaffolding new practices as you go through the courses. That is a very proven learning cycle of learning, doing, reflecting, refining, learning, reflecting, doing. And that's why we see the student impact in these research studies, because I can say with confidence, professors are better teachers when they're AQ certified.
And that's huge, Jonathan. I love that, because even though I'm thinking about it as, you know, I've taught in college for almost 20 some years now, you know, but I've taught high school math longer, and, you know, like, I'm a good math teacher, but I've struggled, even though I have pretty good, I think I have a level up on some of my peers, like Tim mentioned, like the guy who's the world's leading, you know, thinker and researcher in plastic coatings. I mean, he's a genius. We have him on faculty and it's awesome, you know, and I have a leg up because my study was teaching. So I have some hunches about how college teaching could be better. And I have some, you know, advantages coming in because my craft was similar. My expert knowledge was in teaching, and I'm teaching teachers. And even with that leg up, man, it has been a lot of relearning, and it has been a lot of figuring out, okay, so how do adults learn? Because when we learn to be teachers, we learn about childhood development or adolescent development, but there are real ways that we learn differently as adults. And then there's all kinds of new curriculums and new ways that there's research out there on how, say, undergraduate, you know, students in this generation are learning, and diverse cultures. And what does it mean to be, you know, culturally sustaining as an educator in higher ed, and all these things that have come up in recent years that I've thought, wow, even as a teacher, I've needed to dedicate time to become a better teacher in college. And I'll be honest and totally transparent, there's not a lot of time for it. And in fact, there's, and I'm not one of those guys who punches up often, especially in higher ed, because I mean, we all take our turn being in higher ed leadership. It's one of the wonderful things about higher ed is like you would think we have special people trained to be in the leadership, but we kind of each rotate through into it, or get elected into or nominated or draw the shortest straw to be middle management in the chair or the dean, you know. And so as we begin to think differently about leading in higher ed, because I just see, like, I'm curious to pick your brain a little bit. It's like it's been an area where I've noted, man, I need to get better. And I'm pretty good. Like, my student reviews are good, like retention. But even as that, you know, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. And I'm like, I don't know, this is not going as good as it should be.
Well, and you've put your, you know, your sidling up. Can I say sidling up? Is that a horse reference? An animal husbandry reference? I don't know. You're sidling up to this issue of incentives and what matters on higher ed, and presidents and provosts, and deans and department chairs. I have total confidence that the vast majority of professors want to be good teachers. And they would love the time and the support to become better teachers. But, you know, research remains the coin of the realm. And rankings are based on publications and research dollars and selectivity. And we have a Carnegie research classification that everybody wants to be part of. And we don't have a Carnegie teaching classification yet. So you can't blame people for responding to what the culture and the profession and the industry values. So what I have started to spend a lot of time on is thinking about how do we move the sector's priorities, incentives, what it values, such that quality teaching has a pride of place alongside quality research and quality service, the big holy trinity of what it means to be a professor.
And that is where then, you know, and thank you so much for inviting me to the conference this year. When I just see this, though, you're saying, you know, we want to create a movement. AQ's, you know, committed to that movement because it's within that movement that we might be able to say, no, this does matter. It matters a lot. And in fact, I now have a connection through an AQ course that I took at an institution, you know, 1,000 miles away. I have another connection to a leader who's a department head at another place because I'm kind of finding these others at other institutions that have that same desire and that commitment. And you really are building a movement, Jonathan.
Well, that I think that's part of what it's going to take. It's that groundswell of bottom-up activity, professors saying, this is important, we have to do this. And there are very simple things that we can do on our jobs. For example, if we are tenure track, in our regular department meetings, we have a lot of meetings.
Yeah, we do.
Is there a standing item on the agenda to talk about teaching? Are we simply talking about teaching? And getting that on the agenda, it's 0 to 1. It's an infinite change. It sounds small, but it can make a big difference and the start of that larger change. You know, at the same time, I just came back a couple weeks ago from a gathering in DC of sort of policymakers and funders and agenda setters talking about the big incentives that could drive real change, like the rankings, like the classification system, because I think it's going to be that combination of the groundswell saying, we need this, we want this, it's important to do, and the policymakers figuring out how to really incentivize it.
Mm-hmm. The incentives are there too, and you know, pushing's the wrong word, but as Johnny and I continue to talk about this and our connection, the relationship we've developed with you over the past 3 months, and just the conversations we've been having is that Johnny and I keep talking, going like, man, I want to start taking some AQ courses. I want to start doing this. And in fact, you know, we're using this moment to say that we're kind of pursuing that type of a partnership, Jonathan, with AQ, that, you know, Johnny Lupinacci and I hopefully are going to be able to be that kind of first person testimony on a regular basis. You have any thoughts about this potential emerging partnership?
Yeah, I love it. You know, now that I'm president, I don't get involved in these little details. So conceptually, I am 1,000% behind it. And it's going to take your listeners putting their hands up to say, I want to do this. I want my department to support it. I want my institution to support it. Frankly, to take the fear away.
Yes.
You know, we still hear a lot of presidents and provosts fearful of their professors. Now, I think that's crazy talk. I actually don't think that's leadership, because you create the conditions as a leader, the tone, the opportunity, you know, it's in your control as a leader to say, to make your team celebrate your leadership or condemn it.
Johnny, so what about, you know, I know, John, you've said though too, this our own interest is just, you know, I go through the AQ website and I'm looking at the courses and I'm just like, I want to do that. I want to be a part of this, you know, and saying this, John.
Yeah, I think, you know, especially being an educator and knowing that, like, there are areas of growth that we always have. And And I get excited, you know, Jonathan brought it up when at the beginning of this, you know, the second leg of our extended pod, you know, we got a long conversation, but it's connected to all this. A quality education, it looks different at different levels and especially in different subject area, but there's research around what it takes to change instruction. And there are learning needs that demand change in how we teach. We know more now about how young people are learning. And I shouldn't just say young people, about our students, because they may be of all ages, which right. throws a whole bunch of new curveballs. But we have really good research out there on how change of instruction can happen. You know, and I know, even as a teacher, this is the pitfalls I fall into. Even with a really great selection of readings and even with some inspiring, you know, short lectures that are digestible and, you know, fun to have and conversations in class, you know, it's still to have change in instruction. I might know that I need to do different, but doing different is really hard to do. And
that's right. Jonathan was talking about
that AQ does, or Jonathan was saying, is like, you know, we know that it takes hours of coaching. It takes implementing. It takes, and this, we shouldn't need research for this because teachers will tell you this, but teachers talking with other teachers about their students and about the things they're teaching help us to learn to teach differently, to try new things, to not just have the courage to, but to have the sort of wherewithal to change our socialization to, well, you know, my grad teachers kind of taught me this way, sign the readings, talk about the readings, call it good, write a paper. You know, that's college. And we're like, wait, there are so much more to learning, but changing what we do is harder, even when we know better. And I use examples because I know how to be in to design engaging curriculum, and I do it as much as I can. But often I even look back and say, you know, there's a lot I don't know, and I'm not blaming anybody because I'll assume responsibility. It's why I get excited about opportunities to learn. That aren't like, well, here's a book to read. It's like, I've read every book. It's like a golf swing. I could read a book about a golf swing and my golf swing wouldn't necessarily get any better. I need someone to coach me, to give me some feedback, to have me say, go out and try that today. I know it's going to be uncomfortable, but I want you to know to put a piece of paper under your right arm and tuck it in there and hold it down. And even though it's not familiar for you to swing and see if you can keep that piece of paper in there. I need that same kind of thing in a classroom. And we know that's what works when I'm working with a new math teacher in a high school and want them to teach differently, you know? So, but Jonathan, you hit the nail on the head. We don't necessarily have that valued or in place. And again, I'm not blaming anyone because here we are like, hey, let's get better together. But it's not valued. So I'm also curious, like, what do we need to do? What are some of the ways? Because you put it out there, it's going to take that commitment.
Yep.
What are some of the ways when we're having conversations with our school leaders, like, hey, if you care about this, here's something we can do.
Yeah. Well, look, here is a three-word change. Three words.
Yeah.
And I was shopping it around at this gathering. It may have been a little too provocative for the for the attendees, but today, 750,000 professors are part-time. That's half of the 1.5 million professors working today. It used to be as high as 60% pre-COVID. Now, they come in a lot of names: contingent, instructor, adjunct, you name it. But let's, for sake of argument, assume they're basically only being asked to teach. These part-timers are not researchers. Researchers are not part-time employees.
Right.
Now imagine if Congress, in the reauthorization of the Higher Ed Act, or in the regulatory process, if such processes exist post the Chevron decision, maybe the Department of Ed doesn't have any regulatory authority anymore. But imagine if to be eligible for federal funds, professors, or even just part-time professors, had to be qualified to teach. Qualified to teach written into federal law. There's certainly a public interest.
Mm-hmm.
We're spending billions of dollars. Half of the workforce is part-time at a minimum. Higher ed, can you make sure they are qualified to teach? Well, man, I think that would put people in a panic. What does that mean? Qualified to teach. What does it mean? Well, there are actually standards out there. AQ has standards. National Academies is publishing standards this fall. Oh, okay, we've got standards. How do we show people are meet the standards? Well, there are probably some assessments like TVAL to show that a college teaching meets these standards. There are standard aligned trainings and certifications like AQ and others. And if given enough lead time, let's say this was going to be implemented over 3-5 years, you could imagine higher ed pretty quickly, because of this really strong federal incentive, three words, figuring it out. That's one example. We've talked in the past about our Carnegie teaching classification. We're T1 and R1. Mm-hmm. Or we're a small liberal arts college. We're never going to be R1, but we are T1.
T1.
Another example comes out of the UK, which for a decade now has had the Teaching Excellence Framework, and institutions are TEF gold, silver, bronze. A state could do that. Mm. The feds could do that. A nonprofit could do that. There are things, and I know we're not fans of neoliberal principles of competition, but that kind of distinction would create a healthy, positive pressure on the sector.
Well, it's not necessarily competition, but a collaboration, a conversation around these things that you just said. What does it mean to, I know people get all hung up on qualified. Well, then, oh my God, somebody's going to exclude me. And that could be a problem. But what we're saying here is that we could, along with with AQ, and as you say, there are other places doing this, create a movement around having the conversation about how we continue to make a commitment to making teaching truly a priority here. And there are structures that we could put in place that would kind of give institutions an incentive to be better, to claim teaching as an excellent thing. You know, I could just see some small liberal arts institutions just really saying, we really do this well anyway. You mean to tell me we can put it on a t-shirt or a bumper sticker? That's where I see this. And then the excitement here is, so maybe too, Johnny and then Jonathan, as Johnny and I get the opportunity to kind of give that first person narrative about what we feel like as we're going through these courses, and we say this partnership with AQ and Busted Pencils, you know, to sit down and say, guess what? You know what, Johnny and Tim, maybe at the end of this, we can quote, call ourselves AQ qualified.
Well, Johnny. I'm going to put this out there, and I've worked in higher ed for, like Jonathan said, you know, we're successful at being researchers. It's the currency we have to navigate, but I'm also, you know, I like to think of a pretty good educator, and I've worked in a number of capacities on helping to improve education on campus, you know, learning, like how can we work to better connect content with our students in different areas of learning, STEM learning, especially. You know, I have yet to see any model sustainably valued or funded that actually brings to the table the stuff we know we need in order to be a better teacher. Come back to that. Like researchers have studied this. It's not my area of research, although I read about it and I learn from it. I just know there are things that you need to do in order to change how you teach. And it's right. More than just have a list of what those things are to do. There's a lot to it. It's like, I can't just throw a recipe of a cake on my counter and say, we're going to eat cake. I mean, someone's got to bake it. I got to know how to bake. I can follow the recipe. There's a lot to it. So I'm excited that like AQ is doing this, because I've worked in a couple of universities and then been, you know, consultant here or there, a participant. And I'm not knocking, because everyone's trying a little, but not valuing it enough, right? Mm-hmm. There's teaching academies, and there's opportunities to, you know, do teaching leadership and teacher mentorship. And there's a lot of, I'll kind of just throw mud at the wall, because we know it's a problem that we have, and we're not solving it. We're just addressing it in some way. And so I love that there's an organization that's outside, again, that says, hey, we want to partner. We want to be able to provide for you because you don't have enough people to pull this off on your own. And you can't just move somebody who is also researching something else and say, hey, in addition, you're pretty good at teaching. You've done good teaching for a while. Show these other teachers how to be good teachers. You know, well, so that there's an opportunity to learn.
Well, that's right. And now we've been at it long enough. We can show how this is in the self-interest of key decision makers. So, you know, for a president who's worried about the bottom line, president's always got to be worried about the budget. We can now show retention plausibly attributable to better teaching, run that through a very well-constructed ROI calculator to show you're going to make 2x, 4x, 6x return on investing in your people. What a concept.
Right.
For a provost who's under so much pressure to increase graduation rates, right, mm-hmm. and goes to the president and says, give me more money,
mm-hmm.
we can show to the provost, this is, we have the leading indicators, so you're not going to be waiting around for months and months and months, and we've got the lagging data to show increases in course completion and retention. For faculty, I actually enjoy my job now because I know what I'm doing. I'm not an imposter like my students. I don't feel the same imposter syndrome. And for students who actually are having fun learning because the teaching and the learning conditions are well constructed, is that a win-win-win-win? I think we've got four wins.
I love it. I love it, Jonathan. And I got to pick your brain. We'll just talk about this a little because we've been vague about this. And I'll just be specific and transparent with my own teaching. I actually loved school. Not like schooling, but I loved grad school. You know, I was that once I got really interested in particular things like philosophy and, you know, and policies in school and, you know, and all these different theories and ways that we could really think broadly about the world. Love the knowledge of higher education. So for me, and I'm, again, update myself a little bit, you know, like school is mostly, that level of education was mostly go and listen to a really awesome genius talk about that stuff for an hour, maybe more. And I would be like, man, if David Harvey could talk about, you know, capitalism and neoliberalism for three more hours, I would be here just soaking it. It was my jam. So I thrived in higher education, you know, because it was the kind of thing I did. But one, I know that's not good teaching. Two, you know, like for me, I would sometimes love like, hey, I got this grad class on, you know, on school policies and, you know, school reform and all this. And I've just studied this stuff for years. So what I can do is I can talk about it with these students. I can talk to them about it all day. They can listen and they can gain my knowledge, put it into, you know, it's like a banking method in higher ed, even though we're all critical educators and know better. And so, you know, I learned that way. I'm not blaming those folks. I also still honor and was excited that they did what they did, but I know it's not working by and large for most students. So I'm like, okay, how do I learn to do different? And of course, listener out there, I do different stuff. We have like,
no, of course you do. You're a good teacher, but I hate to break it to you, Johnny.
Yeah.
You probably weren't the typical college student, and I hate to further break it to you. It makes sense that you went into teaching both at the K-12 and college level, but we know you're not typical in the graduation.
We absolutely know that
for many reasons, including the college graduation rates. Now, there has been improvement. And again, we honor the improvement. But today, the baccalaureate six-year graduation rate, nobody in America thinks you go to college for 6 years. The baccalaureate six-year rate is 63%.
Mm-hmm.
You got a 2 in 5 chance of crapping out in the poker sense, in the Vegas sense, not in the other sense. At the community college level, it's 30%. and you weight those two averages by enrollment, we're still losing 50% of college students in America. It is such a waste of talent, of time, of potential.
Money,
theirs, ours, right, as institutions. So among those other student success strategies, teaching is such an obvious one. It's such a natural, especially with the data to show we will retain 2, 3, 4, 5% more of our students, at least.
This is so cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and Jonathan, I share that because you know what? I think I have a hunch. Okay. You guys just, mind blown. I'm not typical college student. I thought I was, but you know what? I might be, and you can also say, no, you're wrong again. I might be more typical of the college professor demographic. You know, they learned by being told, they soaked it in, they ate it up, they loved it, it felt good. Then we go
that's right.
Oh, it's exclusionary. That's right.
We succeeded in that modality, and that's why we're in it. And we're recreating that modality. What could be more human nature? But this is about changing the modality, not for the students who aren't succeeding in that modality, and there are millions of them.
So like I did earlier, when in a much more political discussion, I kind of played, okay, but here's some perspectives. Here's what sometimes, and it's not me, because I'm really excited about the change, and I'm really excited. Been actually a few years now, actually decades into being, you know, responsive to students being like, man, that was boring. And I was like, wait, that was just like the most amazing 2 hours of my life. What do you mean it was boring? So I've been in that process, but I'm going to back up to when I was first starting that, or to where some of my peers are at times, and I value that. But I love reading and I love writing, and higher ed is about reading and then writing what I know. And it's been that way. And it's, what's wrong with it, Jonathan? Like, why does it have to change?
Are you asking, should we read and write less?
I'm just curious, because sometimes I feel like the strategies and the different ways that I'm learning to teach differently, you know, I can't cover as much. I have 15 weeks. I have really important. We got, you know, 9 books to read, and you know, and 4 papers to write. You know, or if I'm in the hard sciences, it might be like I have these 12 labs in these 15 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm just saying, like, it feels scary to me that my job is to make sure these students learn all this stuff in 15 weeks.
Yeah.
And this has been the best way for 100 years, Jonathan. Why would I change?
Okay. What works? Well, you know, and I suspect your listeners know the critique of coverage, cover more and more and more. You know, it's not the right mental model. You made reference to Paulo Freire and banking and just putting more and more in. But let's take that example of 12 labs, right? I've got to do 12 labs and lab reports. What are the experimentor skills that we need students to develop as a function of being laboratory practitioners? And do you need 12 to develop the skills? Do you need 12 write-ups to sufficiently demonstrate that I've acquired those aptitudes and those habits that make for good laboratory research? It does challenge us to, you know, go back. What are we actually trying to achieve here? Mm-hmm. And what does it take to get there? It's probably not reading all 9 books.
What?
No, I know.
Oh, I'm with you, Jonathan. I love this
I will never argue against writing, because man, as a writer, there's no better way to clarify one's thinking. But perhaps it's 500 words, not 1,000 or 2,000. I just lit because I'm prepping for my fall course. I just counted the number of words in a New Yorker brief. If you know the New Yorker, there are the longer book reviews, and then there's always a column or four or five book reviews. In 50 words, they've captured the essence of a book. Wow.
Yeah.
That is about depth and beautiful, clarity and focus, not about volume.
Mm-hmm. Every word counts. And I'm with you, like, especially as an educator, you know, writing is a transformative praxis, right? It really helps us to have a conversation of ideas with ourselves. And there's lots of ways to do that and exciting and engaging ways. Jonathan, I love this because, you know, I was playing not quite devil's advocate, just an alternate perspective or a stubborn moment. Sometimes I get in where I'm like, it worked for me. Why can't it work for them? You know, and that to me, that's a little bit real and being honest. When I work with faculty, that we can get some of that on the table. Like some of this is frustrating because it worked for us for a particular reason, but the goal isn't to replicate ourselves in this process. It's to be effective educators. And I'm speaking about like high level grad stuff. Undergrad, it's even more of a responsibility of all of us
to do that
way of engaging different types of learners.
And what are we trying to achieve here? Late in life, I developed a real fondness for Dickens. I think he's funny. Yeah. The characterization, the dialogue, and in the field, I think there's been a reappreciation for Dickens. But in my junior year in college, undergrad, I took a 19th century literature course, and among other writings, my professor assigned Our Mutual Friend, which is easily 900 pages. What possibly was the learning objective in assigning 900 pages? It was not, because I did not get an appreciation for the language, for the development of character, for the exploration of social issues. If that was the objective, it did not happen in 900 pages, which I don't think I got through in college, but did last year and loved it.
But that's the difference too, is recognizing, you say, you what you stated before, you said 900 pages, the goals were blank, the goals were blank, the goals were blank. If we start talking by going, wait a minute, before I assign materials and find things, what do I want the students to quote, learn, achieve, demonstrate, and show me? And guess what? There could be more, God forbid this word, efficient ways to get students to that place. You say it's a goal. There's so much there. Jonathan, though, I know, man, we are just breaking down.
We could do this for hours and hours.
Hours.
It's one of our favorite things, and it's something that like we all like to get better at. Being a better teacher for us is really why we do this, is that we value teaching so much, and it's tangent to our research. I mean, that's the nice thing about being in education research. The two are really constantly feeding each other. So, I mean, Jonathan, appreciate you for, I'm not going to end us, but I just wanted to make sure you get in, appreciate your time and both what you do as a researcher and what you're doing as a leader, leading learners.
The whole AQ putting forward. I'm just going to say the movement, we're building a movement. And Jonathan, I want to say thank you for busting pencils. And I can't wait to hopefully join and become part of this movement with this Busted Pencils AQ partnership. And listener, stay tuned, because we're going to be announcing a lot more about that as the details come together. But this is just a little bit of a tease. And Jonathan, yeah, just one more time. Thanks for busting pencils, man.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for the national conversation you're leading. We said it last time. It is a passion project of yours, and I'm so glad you're passionate about it.
And thank you, listener, for always busting pencils. Stay tuned, man. Lots more Busted Pencils podcasts on their way.